둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell.
Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from County Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season four. I'm Peter Chidi of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
The music world moves fast. Want to stay up to date on the latest albums and get in-depth examinations with the artists? Check out Consequence of Sound, the podcast. Bite-sized album reviews for the music fan on the go who wants to stay in the know, and much more. Subscribe to the series on iTunes or your favorite podcast provider, and let the writers of Consequence of Sound steer you right. Check it out at consequenceofsound.net/COS podcast. Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK, Independent Louisville, at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. If you're not already a subscriber to the series, I hope before we get into this that you hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now. And you can do that wherever you get your favorite podcasts from, including iTunes and Apple Podcasts. Of course, you can also subscribe on YouTube and Spotify as well. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, we are going to take an epic journey with Colin Newman of Wire. It's the 40th anniversary of Wire's album called 154, the 30th of an album we call Ibtaba, which stands for It's Beginning To and Back Again. We'll also talk about his other bands, Immersion and Get Head, and their records that hit big round numbers. And we get a big update on what to expect from Wire when we can get a new Wire album. Yes, it's in the works. It's a 40-year journey with one of the most important bands of all time. And I'm not painting that too big, I promise you. It's Kyle Meredith with Colin Newman of Wire.
So we're talking about some anniversaries here.
We're going to go on a big big old quest, a 50-years quest.
Not quite 50, but still.
Oh, 40-years quest. That's actually right. I looked at my math wrong there for a second.
Yeah. It's not the White Album and it'd be Abbey Road by now. It's 50 years.
Yeah.
I've done something I've never, ever done for an interview before, is I actually read the relevant chapter in Wilson's book and the special edition text on 154, because I think it's really important to have some kind of historical context. And I'll give you the reason why. Because over the last year or so, I've kind of really got seriously into the Beatles again. And I've got, because of the remixed versions that Giles Martin did, which are just, I mean, suddenly they sound like I remember them sounding, as opposed to like a bit horrible. And I've kind of been doing quite a lot of reading on them. And I find that there's just too many people giving their opinions, most of which aren't relevant to anything apart from themselves, the writers. And I think that sort of accuracy in reporting and, I mean, people who are actually, you know, part of the action, of course, can give opinions, but it's just too much stuff. And I'm doing it through that kind of lens of like, okay, this is a historical piece. Other things have been written about it. I've gone on record of saying various things in the past, but maybe I'm looking at that without thinking more about the effect of the records on the listeners. So let's see how this goes.
I love, after all of that setup, it's, well, let's see how this goes.
Well, the thing is that you tend to, with all of these things, you give the answers that you always give. You know, 154 was a famously difficult record to make. Ibtaba was a very was at the end of a very strange chain of events. They're both records which are flawed in some way, from one way of looking at it. Maybe others find them perfect. So I think it's kind of worthwhile giving the time to try and give some special thought. But give me some questions and I'll then find out whether I've got anything interesting to say or not.
Well, I'll take a broad version before we dive right into one of the albums, before we start with 154, because it's interesting the way you painted both of these albums, that they have a similarity in that way. They both did follow something else that was notable for other reasons. You know, your second album's looked at
their third album in a cycle.
Right, exactly. You know, and because of that, I mean, even the albums that they follow, you know, it seems to be, I mean, A Chair's Missing is looked at as one of the all-time greatest albums, you know, period. And I've heard you say many times
That's a fairly recent development. It certainly wasn't 20 years ago. Nobody would have said that.
Oh.
Something which is, it's a development of a critique. It's, to put it in Beatles terms, it's the kind of revolver. It's the one that was never the one that everybody talked about, but suddenly it became everybody's favourite because they realised in hindsight nobody was paying attention at the time, not in the right way. So, yeah, Chairs Missing is, in some ways, I think in terms of the atmosphere of how the record was made, it was almost kind of perfect. I'm not saying that the music is perfect, but the way that it came after Pink Flag. Pink Flag was pretty much a statement about where Wire was in September 1977. It wasn't really a statement about much more in many ways. That was where we got to, and we hadn't been going very long to get there. So unlike other bands who have problems with the second album because they've been playing their first album on the road for 3 years, you know, we hadn't been playing that material. Some of it was actually pretty new. But it was released in the December of 77. By January 78, we were already playing a set that was three quarters, not including stuff from Pink Flag. In other words, we were playing barely none of it live, and we'd already moved on from it. With Chairs Missing, it seemed like we hit a kind of maturity, we hit an understanding of who we were, and we did it as a band. It was very much, you know, it was very much a joint venture. We all we'd all grown together, including Mike. And then 154, of course, was made with the hindsight of having done Chairs Missing, of knowing that we could do it. We could do something really interesting, but then being ambitious for more. But everybody's ambition taking a different form, which is, you know, could be, not always, but could be a recipe for disaster. So those were the kind of context with it. And 154 had a more difficult start because Chairs Missing came, we'd only been rising. There had been nothing that would send us backwards between Pink Flag and Chairs Missing. We were just getting bigger as a band. We were playing to bigger audiences. We were progressing. And then 154 had the very difficult Roxy tour before it that we'd done in the spring or late winter, early spring of that year. And that was a very difficult realisation that actually the music industry in its format wasn't really accommodating what we were or what we wanted. I mean, we were uniquely mismatched. Who would have, you know, Roxy Music and Wire, you would think that's a great combination.
Right.
But, you know, Roxy Music from 1972, 73 and Wire from 79 would have been a great combination, but Roxy Music from 79 were a wholly different animal. Their audience didn't like us. It was costing us money to be on the tour. We didn't really seem to be getting very much out of it, apart from the fact that it was really hard work. It was, in the popular saying, what doesn't kill you, makes you stronger. And it certainly did make us stronger, but it made us also a bit less interested in doing the thing that we were supposed to be doing, which was carrying this forward momentum of this band into a place where, you know, we would become a group that sold a lot of records, and that, you know, it wasn't in our mind that we were never deliberately uncommercial. We were always thought that we were on an ascendancy, and, you know, and the change in the culture of EMI. I mean, we were suddenly in a different place. Well, we perhaps didn't realise it, but both within the band, with the kind of disillusion or the seeds of disillusion that were set with the Roxy tour and the context around it of what was happening at EMI, it did make it a very difficult start to the record, which wasn't helped by Mike coming in on the first day and saying, you just come from a meeting at EMI. You have to remember that Mike was... He wasn't just the producer. He also worked for EMI. He was an employee. He was on Double Bubble, which caused some resentment in the band, I must say. And him basically saying he'd come out of a meeting and, you know, the current direction was that, you know, everybody should be making albums of singles. And that wasn't... we had the material already, and you can see it on the Rock Palace that we were already debuting a lot of that material. And B, yeah, singles were always part of Wire's makeup, but it was never exclusively about singles. That just seemed like, I mean, so we just ignored it. That was not even figuring in our way of thinking about it, but it certainly figured in the way that the record company received it.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about everybody's different ambitions, and I can't help but draw the parallel in a way, you know, if we're going to stick with the Beatles for the moment of the White Album, to kind of wonder if this might be your White Album.
Yes, yes and no. White Album was actually for many years my favourite Beatles record, for all its weirdness. But there's also a bit of Sgt. Pepper's in it, in that we were convinced we were going to make an absolutely brilliant record. We had the arrogance. Mm-hmm. We were at that point, in our own estimation, the best band of our generation, without a doubt. No, I was just, you know, you need a certain amount of arrogance to
sure.
succeed in anything. We felt that people also treated us like that, especially the reception of the album when it came out. So we just had that sense that you know, we were on a mission. It's just the way that people interpreted that was quite different. You know, how if we're it and we're going to make a big artistic statement, that means different things to different people, because the thing about the members of Wire is they're really different people and have very different ideas about what almost anything means.
Coming out of the punk scene, whether you meant to or not, you know, for what you became, because obviously you became something quite different than that. But I guess that was sort of the thing, that you didn't boast about yourself in a certain way, in a certain type of, like, you know, that I don't know. because it did happen. I don't know. It was the way people, as you say, received it. Like, when I look back, maybe thanks to what Roxy Music had done a few years before, like, the age of alternative had begun, as we see in hindsight, you know, as what I think of as alternative, that late 70s thing that you were doing. And sounds were still being created. Going into this, you could have influences, but still make something completely new out of it. And I guess that's what I hear. Like, what were you trying to do musically with this, you know, with your Sgt. Pepper White Album, you know, as we keep going down that lane?
The thing was, okay, to put it that in a bigger context, it's certainly, and this will seem like a strange thing to say, but it's very true. Both Graham and I, we're quite similar in age. He's not even a full year older than me. But we both always had in our minds, the idea of making classic records, that there was such a thing as a classic record. And that, you know, and the other thing, of course, was that, and that was what we'd learned from the Roxy tour, that it happened not just to the 60s generation, but also the 70s generation of people, you know, getting to a certain point and being absolutely brilliant and then taking the sort of completely commercial, being almost an embarrassment to themselves. And we knew that wasn't for us. We didn't want that. We didn't want that for Wire. Wire was too important to take that road. You know, we didn't want to let ourselves down, first of all, let alone let anyone else down. So it was, as always, and everything to do with Wire is driven by the material. It was the material. It was what we had. That material, we'd honed it on the road. We could, as Paul Hardiman, the engineer, said when we turned up on the first day of the session, "Guy, you guys can really play now." That should be taken in the context of the fact that when we did Pink Flag, his opinion was that we couldn't. So we'd had that thing that happened with Chairs Missing, where the whole world had opened to a world of sound, a world of creativity, a world of getting down a backing track, but then all of the work was going into the overdubs. That was all the exciting bit, you know. And there were so many possibilities, it seemed. There were new guitar effects, new ways of working, new ideas. It was about doing something new. So that the ambition, you know, what we shared in ambition was for newness and for making something classic. So I guess that sort of sums up in a different way what you said.
It's really impressive for you all to have been the age that you were and only that far in your career, you know, only a few years into Wire at this point, and to be so aware of the sociology of how a career can work, you know, in the arc. Most artists don't really get a grasp of that until much further down the road.
That's a generational thing also, though. Because, I mean, you see, you know, return to the Beatles, but it would have worked with any 60s artist. I mean, you see interviews with the Beatles in 62, 63, even 64, and they talk like, you know, apart from the fact that they're being, you know, patronized by everybody who's interviewing them, this is only going to last so long, you know, and then we're going to get proper jobs as, you know, writing songs for other people or whatever, this kind of thing. I mean, that notion was gone by our generation. That was not how we were thinking. Mm-hmm. We were thinking this was something that we were doing. We were making a mark, and we would continue to do so. That was different, and we had the example of the artists from the 60s, the artists from the early 70s, what they'd done, how they'd gone, and you know, we were, especially Graham and I, because we're much more in that tradition of, you know, listening to albums. Like Bruce famously always says he doesn't consume music. That's a typically Bruce kind of thing to say, which is to annoy interviewers and take the high ground in almost any discussion. Rob is not also a great listener of albums, you know. So that's, although Graham and I might not agree on lots of things, in some ways we have that similar kind of background of knowing albums and bands and knowing albums that we like and very often agreeing to liking the same albums by the same artist and not, you know, liking the earlier things and not liking, you know, all those kind of things, you know. So yeah, for sure, that was, I don't think that was unusual. I think that was, by that point, a currency that existed amongst people who were consciously, because we were not only creative, but we were also consumers. We had been part of that culture. That culture had been in us, and we had been part of it up to the point we started creating. We just built another layer for ourselves on what else what was existing already.
So with all this, though, you know, complicated time, complicated record, you still do get a classic out of this. I mean, when we look at the song The 15th Now, that's become a classic. I mean, it's been covered by so many artists. Is that something that's also happened, you know, sort of retroactively, you know, looking back on that? Or was that something special from the beginning 15th, for you?
15th has had a very strange history. That's simply because it was a song which I wrote the text and the music. So it was kind of seen as being my song. Bruce didn't play on it, which meant it couldn't be a single, whether or not he did it on purpose or whether he just didn't play on it because he didn't feel like it. I don't know. I mean, I've never really discussed that with him. We did, when we were playing with Margaret in 2008, we brought it into the set. And I remember the very first time we played it in a gig in Rome, and we started playing it, and there was a girl standing at the front of the stage in front of me, and her mouth just dropped open, and she just looked up at me like, my God, I never thought to hear that ever. And I almost burst into tears. I was like, geez. And we played it because one of the things we said to Margaret when she joined, what's your favourite one song? And she said The 15th. We have to play The 15th. And it was good because it came from someone outside of the band, because if I'd have put it forward to play, then it would have been me trying to push my songs. Graham would never suggest playing it because it wasn't something that he considered himself in any way part of. Rob would not make the suggestion either. So it was, you know, it's an odd song. And to be honest, the one that was written as the single was Matt Reff. Matt Reff I wrote as a single. And it was like a proper band song because it wasn't my text. It was Graham's text. I think Bruce had a hand in the text. But it was my tune and Graham's text.
When you say you wrote it for the single, do you go into that specifically saying, I need to write something catchy? I need to write a single?
This is about me, really. It's about my relationship with the band in the 70s. I mean, I was, to use another Beatles sound, I'm of a generation that didn't grow up with the albums, not until Sgt. Pepper's anyway. I didn't own any Beatles albums up to Sgt. Pepper's, but I had all of the singles. Singles were really important to me. You know, and singles were still important in the 70s, doing great singles. And I prided myself on supplying Wire with singles. So everybody could be as weird as they wanted to be, but we always had singles. Because that seemed to me like that was a guarantee that we could make a success of the band and have a broad set of material, which is kind of what everybody likes. It's not like nobody likes in the band besides me likes singles. I don't think anyone would have been able to write a single also. But certainly, you know, there were songs that I knew. I mean, I knew when I'd written Outdoor Minor. I mean, it should have been an enormous hit. I mean, it's reasons why it wasn't, who knows, but I mean, I knew as soon as it was written that this was a classic single in some kind of vein. Had it been released 10 years earlier, it might have been. But you know, it's a piece of British psychedelic pop. You know, Matt Reference is a slightly different thing, but I mean, it's got all of the things that you need for a single as far as I was concerned at that point. So The 15th was just this strange kind of piece. It's got an odd set of chord changes that would mean it's not obviously a single because of the harmonic movement. It's just the way it worked out and made it more singlish because of the attention given to the music. That was a Mike thing. It was actually one of the best things he brought to Wire. And that was one of his concepts, which I still hold to. You work on every track as if it's the single. Because it's true in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, every decade, you know, especially where there's been singles or top tracks, you know, like you have these days. Albums consisting of one or two tracks that everybody knows, been played on the radio lots and have been worked to death, and a bunch of other stuff that fills it out. And we always wanted to make albums, and the way to guarantee that they were really albums was to work on every track like it was a single. That doesn't mean say make it the most pop, but make it the most finished.
Yeah. And I'll cheat a little bit on our timeline by saying that, you know, your most recent records are still so catchy in the way that you're talking about. Like, you haven't lost that. I mean, I will still go back to Nocturnal Koreans, you know, the title track there, and just get lost in that song every time as if it were an anthem. And because it is.
Well, you've got until January next year before the next one drops. And my gut feeling is it's possibly the best one. Like, I don't know about ever, but certainly the best one in the last 20 years.
That's saying a lot right there, because it's pretty stiff competition.
Well, it is, I know. Yeah. I know, if you know, to anyone who's a fan, they know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
We have quite a strong belief in it. I mean, Nocturnal Koreans is, you know, just as an aside, Nocturnal Koreans is in many ways a triumph of production over songwriting. There are a few catchy tunes on it, but it's not really memorable for the songwriting. It's memorable for the fact that it's put together in a really interesting way. I think probably Silver Lead is a bit stronger from the songwriting, but I think that the new album, which is at the moment just called the 2020 album, is the strongest in terms of the songs. But I also feel like I'm stepping up a gear in terms of the production as well, just to take it somewhere else. I mean, let's see how it turns out. I could be completely wrong. But there's a belief in the band that this is a very strong record.
I mean, I believe you just based on it. Because artists, I love a lot of artists who are, you know, have been around for decades, and I still connect to their music and I still love it. I wouldn't always say it's their strongest material in comparison. I without a doubt think that what you all are doing right now has been your strongest material, and I say that still as a fan of the old stuff as well. I mean, it's sort of mind-blowing what you've been able to pull off, you know, this decade.
Well, I think that's to do with hunger and ambition. You know, Wire is, you know, as I've been quoted many times, the most famous band you've never heard of. We've never really been what you would call successful, but we've never been also what you would call unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. We've been somewhere in between. Maybe we have the status that David Bowie always wanted, which is to be a kind of underground cool, but sell enough records to live.
Right.
No one wants to be underground and cool and poor. That's never the aim, apart from Bruce.
Well, I'm going to use
that was completely unfair and should be taken only as a joke.
Okay. I'm actually going to use what you just said there, not the Bruce part. You're talking about, you know, sort of being the underground success, because I'll use that. So now we're going to turn the clocks to 1989, and that's when Ibtaba comes out. It's Beginning to and Back Again, you know, the full title of that. Because, you know, most bands, they get sort of a decade of attention, of success. If they're successful in any certain, you sort of get a decade before your audience drifts and goes. You all were able to flip that around because you took some of that decade off. So going into this next, you know, trilogy of records, if we're going to go there, it kind of gives it in a whole new context to me. Like, what was 1989 like for you all? Did you still feel the strong pull of the same fan base?
It was, the 80s was very different to the 70s. I mean, even with 154 being a famously difficult record to make, it was still, in a way, how Bruce would say, it was done in all innocence. I mean, everyone was, you know, there were strong opinions about what people wanted to do and about how what people wanted to do it. But it wasn't like, yeah, you're an arsehole, you know, I don't want to be in the same room as you. It was like, oh, no, I want to do this idea because this idea is important and that's what I believe in. You know, it was on that kind of level. It was never argued, but it was there in the air. The Ideal Copy was just horrendous. It was, you know, so what had happened in between the 70s and the 80s was that Wire had gone global. Unlike what happens with a lot of groups is they stop making records and they disappear. Wire did something more like what the Beatles have done in the years since they broke up. The audience just grew when we weren't around, when nobody was pushing those records, nobody was promoting them, but the audience just grew bigger and more interested. And in a way, we had to deal with the fact that we were suddenly that band rather than our band. We'd almost been recreated in a different light. I've never said that, but it seems to me that that was part of the issue that we were dealing with. There was, by that point, so much ambition going into it, because the ambition was like, we've got to appear to be ahead of the game. Mm-hmm. that's really hard to do from a standing start, not having really been involved in music at that end of the business for quite a few years. Almost an impossible ask. And, you know, the Ideal Copy was famously the most difficult band record that the Wire ever made. It was a very, very difficult record to make. And one which, you know, I can in some ways look at, you know, there are things I don't love on 154, but I can see from a point of view, because I've been told by so many people who love it, you know, what a great record it is, that it is a great record. And, you know, I have to get beyond my feelings about how the sessions felt and learn to just enjoy it for what it is. With the Ideal Copy, that's much, much more difficult because there was, to quote Brian Grant, who was our manager at the time, there was blood on the walls. Mm. It was absolutely horrible. It was, I mean, I left. I mean, it was just, it was too much. It was not, it was also not, it wasn't, we weren't really making a record together. We were doing something different that we didn't really understand how to do. And it wasn't really working out because everybody had very, very different ideas about how we were supposed to do what we were trying to do. What was a kind of the sort of the next step was a sort of healing thing of like, right, let's try and make a record in a different way. And that was A Bell Is a Cup, mm-hmm. which was generally at the time more favorably received than the Ideal Copy. It's more of a band sounding record, although there's quite a lot of artifice about how it was created. But the defining moment in some ways of A Bell Is a Cup was Bruce's remark as we did the last mix, which was not a major contribution to Western culture, which classic Bruce Downer. but it sort of set the template, you see, because I got persuaded to come back to the band on the basis that I would have more say on A Bell Is a Cup. So it sort of became my, in quotes, album. It wasn't my album, it was a Wire album, but still. I had more idea about the direction it should be going. So therefore, it was decided that Bruce needed a record. Mm. The next record should be Bruce should set the direction of. So Bruce decided that what we should do, and this is the actual Ibtaba as opposed to the version with the extra tracks, was that we should take a live performance from Chicago, strip off everything apart from the drums and the vocals, and replay the melodic content against the voice. It was like a band doing a remix. Mm-hmm. It was quite an interesting idea, although, of course, it didn't necessarily improve the tracks. It occurred at a very, very strange time because we started recording it in November 1988. I know it was November 1988, because then we did it in Brussels because my son Ben had just been born, and Ben was tiny. And the first night of the session, we met up together when they kind of arrived, when they all arrived the night before. And Bruce decided we needed to wet the baby's head. So suddenly we were drinking vodka and champagne, and I got extremely drunk. It was a classic, like, you couldn't make it up, really. This is Wire, it's most ridiculous in a way. So I could barely stand up. So they sort of carried me to my place, rang the door and all ran away. Malka came down and she was absolutely livid. You know, I'd gone out perfectly hewn and come back completely incapable, you know, and they'd all buggered off and left me there. Classic bit of Wire history. I mean, it was kind of, in hindsight, it's really funny, but...
It's very funny, by the way, to me at least, who didn't have to deal with that moment.
I mean, you have to remember, I mean, you know, there is, it's hardest to remember stuff in the 70s, but the 70s, I mean, Wire was extremely silly a lot of the time. I mean, we spent a lot of time together, and a lot of that time was spent making each other laugh. You know, that was one of its great endearments to us. So one of the things that made the Ideal Copy so little fun was nobody was laughing at anything. It was all desperate. At least we had fun when we made A Bell Is a Cup. A classic story. It's probably in the books, but Daniel came over to see how the sessions were going, and Daniel's message to us at the beginning of the album was think pop, and he knew we were going to do a version of Kidney Bingos. Graham had bought a some ridiculous furry sock puppet who he nicknamed the Pope of Pop. And then him and Bruce had shot the most ridiculous homemade video with this love puppet dancing around to Kidney Bingos with really bad effects on it. And we had, you know, so Daniel had come to the sessions expecting, you know, that it could be as bad as what had happened on the Ideal Copy. And Graham said, oh, I've got the video for Kidney Bingos. Do you want to see it? And, oh, yeah, I've got a video already. All right, it's definitely sinking Pop. And so there appears on the TV this ridiculous glove puppet bouncing around to Kidney Bingos. And everybody, of course, burst out laughing. But, you know, there's a bit of classic Wire humour. Ibtaba was... there was very little to remember about it because it was all over very, very quickly. I mean, it was all done... It had to be done around me because, literally, I'd just become a dad and I couldn't leave home. So it was kind of done and dusted. It was a simple idea. We did it. We delivered it. And Mute said, well, that's not an album, really. You need to do some more things. Then where's the single? And so we had another session with a guy called Rico Conning, who did in London. We recorded three songs, Eardrum Buzz, In Vivo, and The Offer. And these were like, you know, we need to have a single. So we recorded them together, and then Rico did some mixes. And then Dan phoned me up and said, what do you think of the mixes? And see, I thought In Vivo was the single. And I said, I hate the mix. Obviously, he hated it. It's just turned into Acid House, you know. This is not, it's dance pop. You know, where's the pop? And he said, oh, don't worry about that. We want Eardrum Buzz as a single. And I said, oh, yeah, that's all right. So Eardrum Buzz came out as a single. And then Gilles Martin, who I was working with at the time, and I mixed In Vivo for the single version, which came out afterwards. Eardrum Buzz was pretty, got a lot of MTV.
I mean, it's your biggest charting single in the US, I believe, to this date, right?
Quite possibly. And that's wholly down to MTV.
And not a sock puppet on MTV.
not a sock puppet. No, not at all. It was kind of an interesting period because we were engaged with the machine. And was part of the thing was, like, with EMI, we refused to engage with the machine because we didn't like them. There wasn't really anybody there we liked that much, apart from Mike. Whereas, you know, when we were on Mute, I mean, it's Dan. Dan says you need a single. Oh, God, Dan says we need to do a single. We better do a single then. You know, it was kind of like that. In fact, Dan was the main reason, you know, apart from the proffered direction for A Bell Is a Cup, Dan was the main reason why I came back after I left. You know, Bruce said to me, you can't do it to Dan. You could do that to EMI, but you can't do it to Dan. You know, we have to promote the record. And so, I couldn't be like that. I couldn't be that person that would just be so uncaring about someone that we liked who had invested quite a lot of money in the band. That seemed wrong to me. So my conscience was like, well, you know, then I should do this. But, you know, let's try and set some rules about how we do this. And there is something very typical about a bunch of blokes, especially British blokes, who like making each other laugh but never talk about anything serious. You know, I mean, Beatles. You know, I mean, it's you know, I just because I've read so much about them, you know, that's you know, I see myself in those people. That's not, I'm sure many other people do as well. That is kind of the way it is. I mean, even now, getting the band to talk about anything serious, it's hard. We've got better at it. I mean, we've definitely got better at it, and we do have meetings now. I mean, the idea of having a meeting in the 70s or 80s would seem preposterous. You know, they would be going down the pub, but that's not a meeting. That's going down the pub, and that's some people getting horribly drunk. That's not discussing anything that you should be talking about.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not talking necessarily about the emotional stuff or about relationships, about things, but even stuff that you need to talk about is about what, you know, it's not like when you take a decision about where you're going or what you're doing and how you're going to do something, these aren't preordained things. They're discussion. What do you prefer? Would you prefer to do it like this? Would you do it like this? Or what do you think? You know, I mean, that even that didn't really exist in Wyatt in the 80s. I mean, what tended to happen was Brian and Bruce would go down the pub and Bruce would just basically tell him what needed to be done. And then the rest of us would find out afterwards. I mean, which was not exactly a great way of doing things. But I mean, Bruce is, you know, I'm not blaming Bruce. Bruce is his own particular person. And his belief in it and his wanting to carry it forward. I mean, he was the oldest member and also the gang leader. So he probably felt that he had a right to do that.
Well, I want to spin the dial just a little bit here because so the Beatles break up and out of that you get Wings. I want to bring up Immersion and Gidhead just a little bit because they both also just happen to have albums that are big round anniversaries and we don't have to touch on it as heavy as we are here with Wire. But that's what I mean. So Wire, you all had put out an album every single year once you got back together through the 80s, right into the 90s, up until, what, 91? I think I'm looking at right here with the... The Drill is what I see as the last one. And then...
I think the WIR album came after that, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, either way, and then Immersion happens. And, it feels like this is probably an important moment for you personally to do something. I mean, you've done your solo record and stuff like that, but this feels like something completely different. Oscillating came out in 94. That's 25 years old. Low Impact came out in 99. That's 20 years old. Sleepless came out last year, and that was one of my favorite albums of the year.
Oh, thank you very much.
Absolutely loved it. What brought this project back, and what's the importance to it now in your life?
Well, the relationship between Gidhead and Immersion is, in a way, sort of quite important because Gidhead became very frustrating to do. And when Mark and I moved to Brighton in 2014, we took two decisions. One was that we couldn't keep going on Gidhead like we were doing because it became like pushing a rock up a hill to get things done and to get the attention to have, you know, a full band on the road and never make any money, and you know, dealing with Robin's schedule became impossible. So we thought, okay, we want to do something that just we can do, just Malka and I. It's like obvious. Well, why don't we do Immersion? I mean, going back to electronic music seemed sensible and logical. It just, you know, typically there has been quite a strong resurgence in electronic music over the last few years. It was something that we felt close to and wanted to do and seemed like the appropriate time to do it. So actually, well, the first was my brain just softened, Analog Creatures, which was the first 10-inch, which was the kind of the thing that we sort of, in brackets, or in quotes, came back with. I mean, we weren't expecting anything. We didn't think anyone would have remembered Immersion. I mean, Immersion reached a kind of high water at the end of the 90s with Low Impact. We didn't play a lot of gigs in the 90s, but we did play the Royal Festival Hall with Wire in 1999. That was a Low Impact show, and that was quite amazing to do it in such a big space. And obviously, the other thing that was important with Immersion coming back is that we can and do play live. And we did an American tour last year, which was quite a big deal to have got round, and it was an amazing experience as well. It was something that couldn't be done with Wire, because for Wire to do a similar tour would be 6 to 8 weeks, and Wired never wants to be on the road that long. Mm. That's why we always have to do America in a kind of special way, because the logical way to do it, the only way Immersion could do it, was to drive the whole thing. There was no other way of doing it. It would have been horrendously expensive to do it any other way. So we drove coast to coast. Well, I've never driven coast to coast in America. I mean, and people always talk about out west, you know, the amazing looking part of the country, you know, and it was a fantastic experience, you know. But the plan is, we've got two ideas we can work on with Immersion. We've been doing this series of events in Brighton called Nanocluster, which are collaborations, and we've been recording them. So we've worked with the German duo Tarwater, who we've known for years, with Letitia Sadier from Stereo Lab, and with Ulrich Snaus, the German electronic musician, and we've got recorded tracks with them, and that would be a record to finish. There's also something we recorded, Matt Schultz from Holy Funk, who did part of the tour with us last year, was on tour in Britain last year and kind of passed by Brighton, and we just jumped in to a local studio and just jammed. Recorded a bunch of stuff, and that might get built up into a record, and we've even spoken to Ulrich about doing something, including having him included in that material, because Ulrich is someone we get on with really well. So that might be where the next direction of Immersion comes from, or we can just decide if that, none of that really floats our boat. We can just start with new material. I mean, it's in one level incredibly easy to do. It's just the two of us. We work very easily together. We're married, you know. That doesn't necessarily mean that it always works, but yeah, it's a great thing. And you know, I personally do rate Sleepless. I think Sleepless is a really good record. I'm always surprised by how well it turned out, and I think it sets a benchmark. And whatever comes out next has to be better than that. That's where I am right now. That's why I'm thinking like I'm thinking about Wire, putting myself under pressure in a good way. Not in an, you know, I mean, that doesn't mean to say that in any way I am responsible for all of the music on these things. It's not even slightly true. What I do is I seem to have an ability to finish things. And that is, it's a skill that most musicians don't have. They don't really know how to finish stuff. I discovered this with Bruce when we were making Send. We would work on things together and we would work really closely. And then when he'd done all the things he wanted to do, and he'd heard everything I suggested, he would just lose interest. I'd say, but it's not finished, Bruce. It's got to be mixed. And he'd just sort of look at me like, yeah, so what? I just started mixing. That's how I started mixing Wire, because Bruce didn't obviously appear to have that much interest in it. As long as what... And that's still the complete rule. For me, mixing Wire. I mean, as long as everybody can hear everything that they contributed to it, they're completely happy if it turns out sounding good, you know. Yeah. It's not like I'm doing some kind of thing which obscures what, you know. I try for high transparency. There's no point in having something in a mix if it's not contributing something. So hear everything. And if it doesn't work, change it to make it so it does work, you know. But that's also done in the construction between us as a band. So there's... You know, I never ever want to overclaim what I do, but I do seem to have acquired the ability to mix things, which I'm pleased about. And as for Get Head, I'm not sure if there ever will. We did have one person who came up to us on the Immersion tour who was really angry that we're not making any more, or we don't appear to be making any more Get Head records.
Well, landing on its 10th anniversary, that's a great record too. I think I've complimented you on just about everything today, so here's just one more for the pile, but. But that Landing record was a really great album.
Landing is a great record. It's interesting that you've chosen Landing rather than Waiting for a Sign. Although I would speak up for Art Pop. I think Art Pop's got some classic tracks on it. Art Pop was very much trying to push it, the envelope of it, as far as we could go with it to make, you know, like it was a pop rock statement. And it's got some great moments on it. Landing, I haven't listened to for a while. I haven't listened to any of them for a while. Landing certainly has. I always associate that with the death of Malka's father, which happened just about when we were finishing it. I think it was when it happened. I'm not sure, but it's one of those. In fact, how life gets
right.
Kind of delineated out was definitely. I think Waiting for a Sign was something where we took a huge risk. I mean, we booked 4 days in Rockfield and with no material at all. And Rockfield is, I've done a lot of recording there, so we can get a preferential rate, but they don't give it away. You know, we didn't have a lot of money at that point. So it was a big risk, but, you know, It's one that I'd love to do that again with a different project, actually, because I think that's a very, very ambitious thing to do, and I quite like the idea of being so reckless.
Well, I'm certainly a fan of every one of these things, and I'm going to use that as you say, you have the talent for finishing things. I'm going to take this moment to draw our own conversation here to an end as well. I completely appreciate all the time today, and thank you so much for kind of pulling the curtains back on every one of these albums.
Well, thanks for. I would get to play Louisville on the next tour.
I would absolutely love that. I know you've.
We didn't get back last time. I think the first time in Louisville was an incredibly memorable experience because Louisville doesn't really count as the South, but it's the beginning of the South.
Right, right.
And yeah, it depends on your viewpoint. You know, for some people it's the Midwest, and so for some people it's the beginning of the South. And we just have never played anywhere in that area before, so it was kind of, it felt like a big step. And then we sort of came back and it didn't feel so exciting going the second time because they'd already seen it once, so therefore we still aren't dead yet, you know, so.
No, we don't.
But Louisville's got a good little scene happening there. And various people have talked, even Botch from our agent has. What did he say about Louisville? But even like this is like a city. People are moving there as a place where it's kind of a cool place to live. Is that? Did I get that right?
It is right, and you can tell by how many hotels suddenly start going up in an area. You start looking at how the real estate works and everything. I think some of it has to do because of how suddenly unlivable Nashville has become for a lot of people. You know, and Louisville becomes sort of the closest little satellite, which it's always been. I mean, we're 2 hours from Indianapolis, an hour and a half from Cincinnati, 2.5 hours from Nashville. And if you want to go the other direction, we're only 4 hours from St. Louis and 5 from Chicago. It's very centrally located with a lot of these places around here. And I think that has, it's that whole small town feel in a big city. You know, it's still a metropolis. You know, there are millions of people here and everything, but you still kind of get that neighborhood feel wherever you live in the town. And I think that's really appealing. And the music does really well here. I mean, we've got a lot of clubs. We typically have an artist that gets some sort of national and international notoriety every 2 or 3 years, you know, and so that always kind of helps with the art scene as well. And you know, and of course, there's just been so many very famous people who have came from here in the past, so it kind of keeps us in the national conversation, whether being Ali or Hunter Thompson or the Kentucky Derby, which just happened, and you know, whatever. So yeah, it's there's your sales pitch.
I think I have a fondness for Louisville. And, you know, note, I did not once say Louisville.
No, you did it right. You did it very right, actually. So well done.
Yeah, because well, that was the first thing you learn when you walk in the door. Say the name right. You know, don't disrespect the people, you know, and say their name wrong to think that you're, you know, some superior person. You know, we don't like it when people say Leicester, you know. So, you know, you say the name of the city like it should be pronounced, and it's good. We did the first promoter. He never followed through. Said he was going to FedEx us, like this, because there's a FedEx center, isn't there, at the airport?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, did the FedEx us local bourbon? Because I remember I don't drink bourbon anymore, but we had a little thing of drinking, Matt and I used to have a thing of drinking Maker's Mark, and he was like, you know, that's the Coors Light of bourbon, you know. I think for people in Britain, you know, I mean, if they've discovered Maker's Mark, they've already got a long way into bourbon, you know. So, you know, to be able to buy, you know, kind of locally brewed stuff, you know, it's pretty going to be pretty rare here, you know, but still. So. Yeah, well, give all my best at Louisville. I've got no idea how the routing will come out. I mean, we are discussing various options.
Yeah, if you drop by here, we'd love to have you.
Cool. Well, nice to speak to you, and enjoy the rest of your day.
All right, you too. Thank you so much, Colin. We'll see you around.
All right, cheers.
All right,
cheers.
Take care.
Bye.
Oh, my huge thanks to Colin Newman of Wire. That was a geek dream right there, I promise you. Hey, before you get out of here, please do me a favor and hit the subscribe button. We'd love to keep you up to date on all of the interviews. We put them out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Consequence of Sound. And again, you can get it wherever you get your favorite podcasts from, including iTunes and Apple Podcasts. And I really do hope that you give the series a rating, maybe leave a review as well. You can also subscribe on YouTube if you're over there a little bit more often, or follow us on Spotify. We've got the series up there as well. After that, you can head to WFPK.org, where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern, where you can also find some bonus episodes of this series. ConsequenceOfSound.net, they've got your music and film news. You can find me at Twitter, at Kyle Meredith, and Facebook, /Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.